Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns. Brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. Listen Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on KKOA 107.7 FM or at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM or to the podcast at lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Now, here's your host and producer, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha, good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. 2018 has been a celebration of a noteworthy event for our state and for our island, the marking of 150 years since the first Japanese laborers came to the island, actually to the state. Today we'll talk about the Ganan Mono, those first arrivals, and the impact of the Japanese in Hawaii. My guest is Arnold Hiura, representing the Hawaii Japanese Center in Hilo. Good morning. Aloha, Arnold.
Good morning.
Arnold, we are sitting in the Hawaii Japanese Center. It's at 751 Kanoe Lehua Avenue. Tell us what this place in Hilo is all about.
Well, I think as you had commented, it may be one of the better kept secrets here in Hawaii. What we are is kind of a hybrid of sorts. We are a community center, and we host a number of activities from meetings to speakers to films to exhibitions. And we've also come to serve as a kind of a repository. We're not a professionally equipped museum or archives, but we have a fairly extensive collection of artifacts leading back to immigration and through the plantation era, and a noteworthy library, actually, that is the result of the collection of Mr. Kiyoshi Okubo. Mr. Okubo was a newspaper publisher, published the Hilo Times, and he was also a radio personality and quite the collector. And so his books formed the core of our library.
Well, you took me back into that library, and I'm using the word huge. It has so many books and publications in it.
Yes, it is rather impressive, if I can say so myself. You know, we receive researchers from both the U.S. and Japan who come here especially to use the library. A lot of one-of-a-kind books going back to the Meiji era, which would be around the time of the Ganan Mono, 1868, as well as works written in Japanese in Hawaii, which makes them all the more unusual.
Well, I noticed also you have the Hilo Times. There was also a Japanese language newspaper published on the Kona side of the island.
Yes, one of the earliest Japanese language newspapers published on the Big Island, or for the state of Hawaii for that matter, was called the Kona Hankyu or the Kona Echo. We have a collection of them, originals, that we are in the process of digitizing. So roughly 1890s would be the publication dates.
Just looking at what a challenge newspapers have today in getting their newspapers published and distributed, I can't even imagine what it was like back then.
The Kona paper has no real advertising that I can tell. So obviously I think for it to have survived at all was more a labor of love than it was for profit. The Japanese were obviously, I think what it points out is that they're highly literate people who valued news and information and writing, recording what was going on. So I think it's very symbolic in that respect.
Well, I was also intrigued in the museum. There is a phrase book that was published at least 100 years ago that has phrases in English, Japanese, and in Hawaiian.
Yes, that particular book, the original is here, and what the Hawaii Japanese Center did some years ago was to reproduce it because it is such a unique and fascinating piece of history because it illustrates that when the immigrants from Japan came, it was not just learning English, but he was adjusting to Hawaii and the fact that Hawaiian was still spoken. A lot of the early Issei, depending on where they lived, were fluent in Hawaiian. One example that we were just talking about in the gallery was a family that settled in Waipio Valley. And Waipio Valley being, you know, a taro growing area, was predominantly Hawaiian. So that family members, the early family members, all spoke Hawaiian.
So we really want to talk about the first Japanese who came to Hawaii really to work in the sugar plantations or do whatever else. I saw that there were some, I will call them errant ships, who either shipwrecked or wandered off course who ended up here. But I really want to talk about the first arrival of the Japanese immigrants around 1868. What brought them to Hawaii? Where did they come from? Where were they going to?
The first group was kind of an unusual group. The Ganen Mono were the first year people of the transition between the Tokugawa shogunate and the Meiji emperor. And as such, it was a rather unusual situation in the sense that the Tokugawa shogun had approved the arrangement, but the Meiji emperor had not.
So there was a transition from shogunate to emperorship. It sounds like a complete transition in government in Japan. So tell us about that first.
Well, yeah, I mean, complete transition is accurate. It had tremendous impact on the nation's policies, taxes, land use, and on and on. Japan went from being a isolated, shuttered nation to a worldly one. At least that was the goal. So as this group of Ganen Mono were put together, roughly 150 of them, recruited mainly in the Yokohama area. And because of that, rather hurriedly organized departure, these were not experienced farm people. They were town people in many cases, which I guess led to some impractical situations once they landed here. They weren't used to that kind of work. The work was harder than anticipated. Benefits were less than what was promised. It was a very difficult situation. They came on three-year contracts. At the end of 3 years, they were free to either go back to Japan, which roughly a third of them went back to Japan. Roughly a third of them proceeded on to California, and roughly a third of them stayed. Because they were on one ship only, and immigration had been stopped by the emperor, they married Hawaiian women. They were mostly men who married Hawaiian women and became part of the general society here, which is very important, I think, because for those who stayed, married, and settled in Hawaii, they were thought upon favorably enough that King Kalakaua went back to Japan to negotiate additional immigration, which restarts once again in earnest in 1885.
Who had the idea to recruit Japanese laborers in the first place? Why was it needed, and why Japan?
Well, I'm not sure of all of the reasons, but the need for labor on Hawaii sugar plantations started with actually the importation of Chinese. After the Chinese came the Japanese. I believe because of Kalakaua's favorable impression of Japan, a greater effort was focused on recruitment in Japan. So when it restarts in 1885, then you find the heavy immigration coming from southwestern Japan, Hiroshima, Yamaguchi. Those prefectures have the highest numbers. Niigata, lesser. Anyway, these were people who, for various reasons, were looking for a means to make money, to improve their situation, because they had been put in a very difficult position. There's a tradition in Japan that's called dekasegi, which means to go out, make money, come back, help the family. So I think for a lot of these people, it was a three-year commitment. It was out to make money, help the family, come back to Japan. But circumstances changed and people ended up staying in Hawaii or moving on to California. Any kind of situation like that, there's always a push-pull. There are factors in the homeland that are pushing people to go out. And there are people who are, in the case of Hawaii, active recruiters are going, please come to paradise, you know. We'll take care of you, beautiful Hawaii. You'll find your fortune here. So the push-pull actually ended up bringing estimated between 180,000 to 200,000 between 1885 to 1924.
You noted that on the very first ship of roughly 150 people, most were men. What would have brought women? Were they married to the men or were they not?
Yeah, I believe the women that did come, maybe about a half a dozen or so, were already married. They came as couples.
I have heard about picture brides. To what extent did the single men here in Hawaii use that picture bride system to find wives, or do you think most of them did in fact marry women who were already here, Hawaiian women?
The Ganen Mono group is fairly isolated in that respect because they come in 1868 and there is no more immigration until 1885. There's no mechanism or means of introducing yourself or bringing people over. So the ones that stayed married Hawaiian women. But when the mass immigration restarts in 1885, then you have ship after ship after ship that's coming. And again, many of them are younger men, able-bodied men, out to work in the plantation, make money, and go home. They come here, and for different reasons, they don't go home, and they want to get married. So that's where it starts. It's called Picture Bride, but it's not like a catalog kind of thing. You know, I think people get the wrong impression. It was an arranged marriage, and arranged marriages were fairly traditional in Japan and elsewhere, not just Japan. So these are people who know each other's families, who have a go-between, an intermediary, a matchmaker, people who, I guess, would be good couples. I guess they made their best match. And of course, in many cases, pictures were exchanged. That's the origin or the background behind the picture brides.
As we were walking around, I saw a reproduction of a note from one of the emperors to the people who were leaving Japan. And it basically said, go for 3 years, be good, make money, and make sure you come back. So how did the Japanese government feel about those folks who chose not to come back? Were they essentially disowned by Japan? Tell me what you know about that.
That particular note that you saw was actually written by the governor of Hiroshima to departing emigrants as they left for work in Hawaii. I'm not sure exactly how they were treated. I know that they kept their citizenship, the first generation. Second generation, of course, were American citizens. In some cases, they were dual citizens, registered with both Japan and U.S. up until World War II. I guess at that point, it was very clear that for most Nisei, they wanted to repudiate their Japanese nation and be 100% American, because that's what they were.
And the Nisei are the first generation that's actually born here?
Yeah, the first generation that's born here. The immigrants count as one, so their children are counted as two. As a result, I think many families from Japan who trace their ancestry back to Japan are fourth or fifth generation now, but except for the Ganin Mono. They got a jump on everybody by some 15 or so years. They are into their sixth or even seventh generation. Because this year was a Ganin Mono celebration year, we heard that several new babies were born this year, which meant those families were seven generations deep.
Well, when the Japanese first came here, the Hawaiian Kingdom was the government. It was not part of the United States at that point. So did those Japanese who came here, did they become citizens of the Hawaiian Kingdom? What do you know about that?
No, they were not citizens of the Hawaiian Kingdom, as far as I know. They were, like in the case of the Ganin Mono, many of them married into Hawaiian families, and so they lived their lives as local citizens, but I don't think they were legally Hawaiian citizens.
Interesting. And then I suppose after the overthrow in 1893, then everybody in this territory, in the territory of Hawaii, would have been considered an American citizen. Curious questions about citizenship. What was life like for the workers who came over from Japan, mostly to work on sugar plantations? And by the way, I heard that this was not the first island to which they came. So let's start with that. Where did they go when they first came to the state? And then when did they get to the Big Island?
Immigrants landed in Honolulu Harbor, the main immigration station there. They were processed, given health checks, etc., and then assigned to different plantations. So they'd have to take a neighbor island trip to get to Maui or Kauai or the Big Island. Again, work there 3 years and decide what to do from there. You know, a lot of these people came with different kinds of skills or experiences and were eager to leave the plantation and go do their own thing. So carpenters, for example, or tailors, or laundry people, or landscapers, or farmers. A lot of them went to Kona and got involved, heavily involved with the Kona coffee industry there. Many became shopkeepers. So became even more embedded into the society because they started taking on all these different roles. They weren't just plantation workers. They were all kinds of craftspeople.
When they first arrived and they were working on the plantations, what do you know about what their life might have been like?
Everybody talks about hardship, housing conditions, medical care. I mean, you name it, it was very limited. Workers were pushed to the brink. The work was hard labor, hot sun. You also hear of the other side as well. I mean, I think for a lot of them, they found life on the plantations also offered them a sense of community. I think Hawaii is unique in that respect, that these multi-ethnic, multicultural communities were able to flourish in spite of their different cultures.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues, and I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bracken. We're on the radio on the Big Island of Hawaii every Sunday, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, 8 a.m. Lava 105.3 FM. And then we post the interviews for anytime listening at lava1053.com and at koacountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the microphone. Today, we're airing a conversation with Arnold Hiura of the Hawaii Japanese Center at 751 Kanoilehua Avenue in Hilo. We recorded the interview a few weeks ago, and as I've been editing it, getting it ready for air, I've just been enjoying it so much that I want to continue the conversation. So my guest next Sunday morning is going to be Walter Kunetake, who's with the Kona Japanese Civic Association. Walter was raised on a coffee farm, and his mother, Kiono Kunetake, was a force for the Big Island. We'll talk about the Japanese as farmers, the other roles that the Japanese played on the Big Island and in the state, and we'll talk a little about the influence of the Japanese in politics. I also want to hear more about the current activities of the Kona Japanese Civic Association. Membership in that, by the way, is open to anybody. I'm a member, for example, and I'm not Japanese. For now, let's get back to our discussion with Arnold Hiura about the first Japanese who settled here in Hawaii. Well, you mentioned that some of the people, after leaving the plantation, went, for example, into Waipio Valley, where they really had to be able to thrive in a primarily Hawaiian community, even learning to speak Hawaiian. So they had to speak Hawaiian and Japanese and English to get along on this island.
Yeah, and I think, again, once you stepped out of the traditional role of a plantation worker, and let's say if you opened a store, people would come to your store, and you'd have to greet them, you'd have to service them, you'd have to provide them with goods and services that they wanted and needed. Your customers would run the gamut of it, Chinese, Hawaiian, Filipino, Portuguese, Puerto Rican. You had to serve all of them. You'd learn enough, if not learn every language, at least know the familiar, useful phrases. You know, food was a medium in which people exchanged culture. Hawaii people, even on the plantations, would share food. A lot of our local dishes are actually created because of different influences, cultural influences.
At the time, the Japanese, mostly men, some women, were still laborers in the plantation. To what extent do you think they got involved in the broader community? Clearly, after the Japanese left, they became very involved in the broader community. But while on the plantation, was that part of what they were able to do, or were they totally focused on their work in the plantation? That's all they had time and energy to deal with?
No, I think they were actively involved in various kinds of ways. The plantation encouraged participation in sports, for example. People got involved with school, education, religion. Churches were built, various denominations. And Japanese were active in all of these fronts, eventually organized labor, politics. Yeah, you had involvement on different levels, opportunity to get involved, be active, participate in a leadership role across ethnic differences.
Well, clearly the Japanese really did that, particularly the members of the 442nd returned from World War II, and they became very active in Hawaii politics. You know, we've heard a lot about the involvement in World War II, but Japanese arrived here before the Spanish-American War. They were here during World War I, but I haven't heard much about the role, if any, of the Japanese in those wars when they were living in Hawaii. Do you know anything about that?
No, not much, except for the fact that, yes, there were Japanese immigrants, Issei, who did fight in wars prior to World War II. We have in our collection a World War I uniform that belonged to Sanji Abe. Abe was also active in business and politics and all kinds of different things.
By the time World War II came along, a lot of the Japanese had obviously left the plantation life. They were very active in many of the activities you've spoken of. They had stores, they had coffee farms, they were really a force on this island. World War II came along, and all Japanese and Japanese Americans on the west coast of the mainland were interned. That was not the case in Hawaii, where it looks like what the United States government did was only imprison those Japanese who were considered to be the most influential, the leaders, the teachers, those kind of folks. Talk about the impact of the war on the Japanese and Japanese Americans in Hawaii at that time.
Well, naturally, people of Japanese ancestry, whether they were first or second generation, were looked upon with some suspicion. And I think it was really a matter of how they responded that determined what their future was in Hawaii and the future of their children. I wasn't around at the time, but we hear stories of people destroying a lot of their family objects that were of Japan. Any picture of the emperor burned, you know, things like that. Even very valuable collectible items like samurai swords and things were thrown or buried or burned. And in its place was kind of a more of an all-American display of we are true Americans. So Japanese could not congregate in groups. So that meant all the Buddhist churches were shut down, things like that. Even weddings were limited to the bride and groom and two witnesses, I believe.
Wow.
So no big bridal party or reception to follow or anything like that. Any kind of gathering that involved people of Japanese ancestry was limited.
What about the Japanese schooling? Because I know many people that I've heard talk about going to Japanese school, even during that time, that was children. So did that stop for a while?
Oh, yeah. Language school teachers were one of the first to be arrested anyway, as well as ministers. Some business people, especially those who had, let's say, those who had an import-export relationship with Japan and had an unusually high amount of trips to Japan or correspondence with Japan, were under suspicion. Things like that. Some of the martial arts sensei were selected out for arrest. But, you know, the selective arrests of certain people only, I think, compounded the level of uncertainty and suspicion. It was kind of like, why did they pick our neighbor and not us? Or why did they pick us and not them? Some families have told me that during the war, they were ostracized because their father was arrested during the war. It was, in some ways, even more insidious than taking the whole group of them and packing them all off to camp. By selectively picking out certain individuals only raised the fear and the suspicion and uncertainty. It made for a very difficult situation. Of course, the 442 is probably the most famous. Along with that, you should mention, of course, the MIS, Military Intelligence Service, 1399th Engineers. And these were all Nisei-based fighting units.
You have a uniform here of somebody who you said was in military intelligence. What was that function exactly?
These were Nisei who had some knowledge of Japanese. And they were selected, rather than go to the normal infantry boot camp, they were sent off to language school and were used to monitor transmissions, later on interrogate POWs, things of that nature. So the uniform that we have is actually a flight jacket. It belonged to a local family. The father signed up to serve in World War II and was selected and sent to intelligence school and assigned to a bomber squadron over the Pacific. My understanding is that you had your headset on, you had your oxygen mask on, but you weren't in any form of pressurized cabin, so it must have been freezing cold up there. So every time I look at that flight jacket, I wonder how they survived those conditions with just that jacket.
Well, you also have a wool coat that they wore in combat, I think, in Europe. And I frankly don't know, given how heavy that coat is, how they managed to wear that coat and even move.
Yeah. To be honest, I mean, a lot of those Nisei guys who were 18, 19 years old weren't very big. My understanding is that it took special effort to outfit these guys because the standard issue military gear was too big for them. But yet when you lift that wool jacket, because you got to understand that they fought in Europe through the winter, through Italy, France, Germany, and slogged through mud and snow and all of that. So they had to have that wool coat, but the thing weighs a ton. So it's always been my desire to set up a display where, say, a young person, high school age person, roughly the same age as one of these young recruits, Nisei recruits, would have been during the war, put on the jacket, put on the overcoat, put on the helmet, strap on the munitions belt and the canteen and boots and all of the stuff that these guys had to carry, the rifle, of course, and make them walk up a set of stairs.
And see if they can do it.
Yeah, I would struggle. I would struggle mightily. So these artifacts can tell stories. They're capable of telling stories.
I know that people of Japanese descent have been active in Hawaii politics for a long time. Certainly after World War II, that became even more evident. And in fact, when I had the wonderful privilege to interview Senator Daniel K. Inouye, he talked about that being a concerted effort. Governor John Burns was an example of somebody who really tried to promote young Japanese men going off to law school, coming back, being able to serve Hawaii. Talk about the influence of the Japanese in Hawaii politics, the rise of the Japanese, and that influence here in the state.
I guess you have to remember the context, which is that Hawaii was a very different place back then. People refer to the Big Five. What the Big Five referred to would be interlocking directorships between businesses, banks, and social organizations. And basically, you have a small minority of people that control life in Hawaii in general.
And the Big Five were sugarcane companies, very active in the late 1800s and well into the 1900s. Castle and Cook, Alexander and Baldwin, C. Brewer and Company, AmFac, which was American Factors at the time, and Theo H. Davies.
Yeah, so for a lot of these soldiers who fought valiantly in Europe, and they may have left as plantation workers, plantation kids, but they came back very much more worldly in their perspective. They were heralded as heroes, and yet many of them felt trapped into going back to the life they led before they went to war. But then there was something called the GI Bill of Rights, which made an unaffordable education affordable. And so for many of them, it was an opportunity to take that step and do something other than just go back to work and accept things the way they were. But even after they came back with their college degrees, a lot of them still felt that the glass ceiling, as it were, existed. Nothing changed. And that the only real way that they could make those changes was through the political process. And so they were, as you said, inspired by people like Burns and others to organize. They didn't have a lot of money, but they could garner a lot of votes. Just sheer numbers. Politics is just sheer numbers. So at one time, just the Japanese Americans alone would have been close to 40% of the population. So with those kinds of numbers, if you mobilize, you're going to be successful. And that's kind of what happened. They organized themselves. 52, the McCarran Act, allowed for citizenship. Japanese, until that time, could not become U.S. citizens, but that allowed them to become citizens, and many of them did. So all that did was raise the number of votes. And it was not just AJAs, but when you look at the role that organized labor played in driving post-war politics in Hawaii, then you look at organizations like the ILWU. They were multi-ethnic, very self-consciously multi-ethnic.
When you say very self-consciously multi-ethnic, meaning they wanted to draw in Americans of Japanese ancestry along with the others?
It was kind of like, this is my observation, ILWU, if they had five officers, they would have one Japanese, one Chinese, one. If they would have a May Day court, there would be one Japanese, one Chinese, one Filipino, one Hawaiian. You know what I mean? So you would have representatives of each different ethnic group on all the major functions. I think that was significant and did have an impact on local politics. So it wasn't just AJA Nisei soldiers, it was others participating in that process following the war.
Well, as you point out, there were a lot of different groups that came here, a lot of different ethnicities. This is the first I've actually heard about a union being so deliberate in its choices, and obviously that's pretty important for a union if they want to stay in power. So fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, I spent some time going through the ILWU library on Oahu, and as you flip through their photo archives, it just jumps out at you. I mean, here's a big event or here's a big meeting taking place, and you look at the faces across the stage or the names in the caption, and there's one of each every single time. In some cases, they would even say Filipino representative, the so-and-so officer, and they would be identified in that way, all but guaranteeing that you would have a multi-ethnic group of people represented every time the union went forward in public. And they were very good at organizing, obviously. Very important to being successful in politics.
Obviously, we live on a multicultural island. I'd say more multicultural, more multi-ethnic than some of the other islands. Talk about Japanese culture and how it affects our life today here on the Big Island of Hawaii.
Japanese people are actively involved in all forms of activity here on the Big Island. I think some of the more visible ones would be in the business community. Companies like KTA, multi-generational business, 6 or 7, I think now, locations around the Big Island, very active in the community, involved in all kinds of fundraising activities and school-based activities. HPM is the same kind of situation, Suisan company, trucking companies, active politically. In a way, it may be a little misleading to say Japanese Americans or Japanese culture is influencing life here on the Big Island. It's really kind of a collective kind of thing. Japanese culture as such has become localized. A lot of the values, you can't say, oh, these are Japanese values, because you find similar values in other ethnic groups. Almost every single one, if you took the time to really break it down and say, what are the core values in Filipino culture or Portuguese culture or anything else, you kind of find that there are these values that kind of cross over. More likely than not, they form the core values of what we call local. So I think that's kind of the message we try to portray here at the Hawaii Japanese Center, that you may start this discussion with Japanese history in mind, Japanese culture in mind, but you can't get to the present without understanding and appreciating how all these different values have come together to form what we value today as local.
Arnold Hiura, if people want to visit the Hawaii Japanese Center at 751 Kanoi Lehua Avenue, when is it open to the public?
Our hours are Wednesday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Fairly limited hours because we have all volunteers and we do a lot of stuff in the back. But welcome to please email us. We are online. We have a website. Either email us or call us if you'd like to set up an appointment. We'll do our best to accommodate you or your group.
What's your email address and your phone number?
You can reach us at contact@hawaiijapanesecenter.com. Our phone number is 934-9611.
Arnold Hiura, thank you so much for talking with us today. Aloha.
Thank you very much for visiting us and for featuring us on your show. Aloha.
And that was Arnold Hiura of the Hawaii Japanese Center in Hilo. To our listeners, thank you so much for being with us. You know, Arnold mentioned how multicultural our island is, and today celebrates Sakata Day, appreciating the rich history and contributions of the Big Island's Filipino plantation workers today at Kulaimano Community Center in Pepeakeo from 10 until 2. This is Island Issues, and I'm Sherry Bracken, your host and producer. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues, brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us at info@labo105.com. Join us again next week for another Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.